Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
And good morning. Welcome to What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR. Our guest this morning is Carolyn Kirkwood. Carolyn is a licensed clinical social worker, and her practice is called Kirkwood Therapy. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
This is a recurring subject on What's Next, of talking about mental health. And our producer, Charles Gilbert, as a matter of fact, is going to be perhaps adding a little bit of context to things. Charles, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jay.
Of course, you have hosted programs on mental health on What's Next before.
Yes, I have. I am very interested in having this conversation.
Excellent. There's a lot to get into, and we're going to do that right now with Carolyn. Carolyn, it's interesting. I want to get to your background story just a little bit. You
sure.
told me this before we went on the air. You set out to be a teacher like so many of us. What a funny thing happened on the way to becoming a teacher. What happened to you, Carolyn?
So I thought I wanted to be a teacher. I love little kids, and I went to school for teaching. And I went through all the classes, and when I got to the end to do the student teaching, I realized, no, thank you. It was not what I wanted to do, and I didn't find the most joy in it because I realized at the time that I had a lot of empathy and sympathy for the kids.
Right.
I was working at a school in the Black community, neighborhood school. All the kids kind of like walked to school and stuff. And the kids would come with no food and didn't have the uniform and things like that. So I felt myself more connected to that side of it than the education side of it. But I still didn't realize that it was social work just yet. A few years later, I became a foster parent. And being a foster parent, I adored it so much that one of my foster kids I adopted. So one of the four children that I have is adopted. And while I fostered 17 kids.
Fostered 17 kids.
Yeah, yeah. I loved it. And throughout that time, I felt myself really connected to the story of the child, the background of this child, and really working with parents.
Right.
I met different parents who had fallen on hard times, of course, considering that the child was in foster care with me. And I just had a natural connection to encouraging parents and just kind of helping work through different challenges with them so that they can just regain custody of their child, working on different parenting skills and just mental health. All the things that are connected with a child being in foster care. And then that was when I realized that it was social work that was, you know, in my core, that was my background, that was where I needed to be. And so I did finish the bachelor's degree because I was already at the tail end of it. And then when I went back for my master's, that's when I started the social work career. And now here I am.
Here you are with your own practice,
yeah.
That's for sure. But we've had a couple of programs on foster care before. And since you brought it up, and if you don't mind, maybe if we could just explore your experience just a little bit more. 17 kids.
Yeah.
And it must, I hate to use the term break your heart, but to know that there are so many kids who are waiting for foster help. Well, let's just talk about maybe that as well. You obviously loved it and love it. 17 kids. What did you love about it that struck you to the point where you made that kind of commitment?
So one, I love children, which is why I thought I wanted to be a teacher.
Sure.
So I'm a natural nurturer, so it's natural for me to love and care for a child. So that was the thing. But then A lot of the kids that I had were children of color, children from BIPOC families. And I just had a different experience. I won't say that I was heartbroken. I was excited to have an opportunity to offer love and a safe home to these children. Mm-hmm. Because I've heard so many stories of how not so fun foster care can be, not so safe, not so loving for kids who are already falling on hard times.
Yeah.
And in my core, I wanted to make a difference. And it was natural and easy for me to make a difference because I'm a loving person and I have food, you know? So
you'd like to think that there are millions of people who fall under that category, but people would tell you otherwise.
Yeah, but it truly came easy and natural, like completely effortless for me to take another child in and offer them love, a safe home, and three meals a day and snacks.
Right. You know? What do you think makes a difference? Like you said, you know, you thought, you know, you just laid it out. I can love, and I got food in my house. That's all that's needed. Yet most people do not, you know, open up their homes to foster care. I guess, can you again maybe make a comparison to what you see the failings are in other circumstances? Again, I hate to focus on the negative, but you know, there's a lot of
issues
there.
People do fall on hard times.
Yeah.
And I truly believe, and from what I've seen, is that mental health is usually the biggest barrier to families. And when your mental health is less well, you can't be your best self. You can't be your best parent. You can't be your best wife. You can't be your best whatever you are, whether you're a bus driver, a nurse, you know, a waitress. You can't be your best self if your mental health is less well.
Right.
And so that is what really drew me closer to the mental health field, because I saw a reoccurring theme of the parent is in a domestic violence situation, or they have different mental health challenges where they can't be present. They're not working, so they can't provide the food for their child, or, you know, whatever the situation is. And it's usually, it always turns back to the mental health of the parent, which causes the disruption in the home and lands the child in foster care. But then it creates a repeating cycle, because now this child is dealing with separation anxiety and abandonment issues. So now their mental health is less well. And so it builds that cycle of now the parent was less well, so now the child is less well. And now, you know, it just kind of goes around and around and around. And so I really love being the chain breaker there, you know, and kind of ending that generational cycle to where now this child is in my home. We're going to get counseling. We're going to be, you know, constantly doing group therapy and giving them love and just kind of showing them a new way of life while the parent is also working on themselves, you know?
Absolutely. And thank you for doing that. And thanks to anybody who continues to be a foster parent. Seriously. I mean, when you really get right down to it, what a huge service to society it is. I mean, there's no other way of looking at it because, you know, kids are, so, I mean, again, I don't want you to necessarily breach privacy here, but can you talk about maybe like a circumstance that when you think about one of those foster kids that came through your house that, yeah, boy, you know, this kid was really up against it.
So I had a foster child who I believe just never stood a chance because their mom was addicted to drugs and alcohol. And so before this particular child was born, the older sibling was born. The older sibling was born and addicted to cocaine. So right from the hospital, that child was placed into foster care. And what was troublesome to me is that the mom never stopped using. And so she never got the help that she needed. So when she had the second child, which was the foster child that came to stay with me, this child was also born addicted to cocaine and alcohol. The child was diagnosed with fetal alcohol syndrome. And it's just very troublesome and very sad because this baby was born into this, didn't ask to be here, never had a chance, you know, because of the decisions of mom, because mom was not well. And
right.
She never got the support that she needed. So she's continuing to have these children that are born with challenges, you know?
Sure.
And so that child just really, really had a special place in my heart. So it was situations like that, that really, you know, and it gave me the fuel to just keep doing the work, you know, keep offering the children love.
Sure. And you also talk about your interactions with the parents, the biological parents as well. Talk a little bit, again, maybe give us a little insight into how that worked for you, how maybe you handled it, maybe, because it sounds like for you, this all works out very well. You could handle it. And but yeah, I've met, you know, foster parents who, you know, they couldn't get through those those stressors. So what
I think
about that
has a lot to do with why I started my private practice, Kirkwood Therapy, is because those parents needed the support. They needed someone that can understand their perception and that is unbiased and non-judgmental to kind of talk to. So like that particular parent, we talked about like using drugs and stuff. And because I'm not Child Protective Services, she felt more comfortable talking to me about it or being open and honest about it. And it was really those conversations that really drew out that side of me where I realized like, I can do this, you know, and it's needed to really become a therapist, to like really be doing this work every day with people, having these conversations every day with people. And we had a conversation one time and she was just saying how like, I want to go to treatment, but I don't want to look like a bad person or a bad mom. And she just felt, she felt stuck because there's a stigma against going to treatment and getting the support that you need. And, you know, you do have to be away from your children to go to inpatient and get the support. And so she really just needed a lot of encouragement. And I told her, I said, listen, nobody is judging you. We all fall on hard times here, you know. And I talked to her about, you actually look much better as a parent by letting your child go to foster care so that you can get the support that you need, you know, really focusing on yourself and just trusting that your child is in a safe space and that while your child is safe, that you can go and get the support that you need. So that way, when you come back together, you both are in a much better place, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And boy, you really are taking me down, I think, a fascinating road of understanding some life situations that a lot of people don't experience. And I'm wondering about that, just like you said, that stigma of going to treatment. I can certainly appreciate that. And I guess what I'm wondering from you, now that you are in your own practice, you have these interactions in your home with a biological parent as a foster parent, but do you have an understanding of why that stigma is there and, you know, what we could do maybe to break that down a little bit and try to, you know, give the kind of support that that's needed? Because it, I mean, it's really unfortunate that, you know, somebody feels that they can't go get the treatment that they need because there's something there that's blocking.
I think that the stigma is there for different reasons.
Okay.
But one reason that I can pull out is that for a long time, mental health was such a taboo topic. And not only was it a taboo topic, it was almost like it was frowned upon. Like if you were to admit that you were struggling with anxiety and depression, you were air quote crazy.
Right.
Or, you know, you were admitted into an intensive, you know, rehab program or something like that. And so because of that, people are afraid that I don't want to lose my kids just because I'm admitting that I'm struggling with depression. I don't want to be admitted to an inpatient rehab because I have a little bit of anxiety. And so people just don't say anything. They do nothing about it. They keep it to themselves. And then they just struggle and struggle and struggle for years. So that's a reason. And then it's like for men, men have always been raised to be tough and, you know, be guarded and not have feelings, not show emotion. And so when you have been taught that from the time you were three, if you were to fall down, you were told that you couldn't cry if your knee was bleeding, you know, and that's kind of instilled in you. So you go throughout life with that guard up. And then as life starts to life and you start to go through different things, you have never learned how to process, have connect with your emotions, to be honest with yourself that you have an emotion because you've always been told not to. And so it's reasons like that why the stigma is there. But to the second part of your question, you asked how to change that and break that barrier.
Right. Yeah, but pretty big question, right?
Yeah, but I think that it's a great question because I believe that now we're coming to a place where mental health is more common and it's almost like a trendy thing, but I'm okay with it being a trendy thing because a lot of people need it.
Sure.
And a lot of people go with the latest trends. So if that's what it takes for you to get the support that you need, I'm with it. I'm in full support. you know?
Yeah.
And so it's more talked about. It's more socially acceptable. It's more accessible. And that's one of the things that I really appreciate about Kirkwood Therapy is we do telehealth therapy. And with telehealth, you don't have to get a ride there because it's virtual. As long as you have a platform with a camera, you can get your access. You know, we take insurance. So if you don't necessarily have the money to pay for it, your insurance will cover it. And so I say all of that to say that like the stigma is changing,
right,
and the access is expanding as well for people to, you know, really, really dive into therapy.
We were talking with Carolyn Kirkwood this morning. Carolyn, licensed clinical social worker and also her own practice, Kirkwood Therapy. She just mentioned it as a matter of fact. And you touched upon something about the benefits of the teletherapy. And we got into this before we went on the air, and I want you to kind of go back to it.
Mm-hmm.
How teletherapy has kind of relieved at least some of the stressors that some people or barriers.
Yep.
People might face when it comes to getting therapy. But at the same time, there are, I mean, you also opened the door to a lot of the other kind of existential, real basic elements that people are struggling with, you know, day to day, and mm-hmm. how it's impacting their mental health. Talk about some of those things.
So the struggles that people go through day to day that impact their mental health include poverty, mm-hmm. just all of the things that comes with that. Lack of transportation, lack of childcare, don't have food, low income, things like that. And when you can't feed your family, you don't know where your next meal is going to come from, or you have to choose whether to buy food or buy diapers. It really weighs on your mental. And then when that's your life every single day, every single week, and you can't get from under that, it can really, really impact your mental health. But I also want to acknowledge that mental health doesn't always come with a rhyme or reason. So a person can very well be depressed because there's a chemical imbalance in the brain. It doesn't always have to be situational. So sure, there are situations that really trigger depression and anxiety. However, there are people who are seemingly to the eye perfect. They're rich and, you know, they're celebrities even. And they have $1 million and they have parents and they have children and they have all the things that one would think would make life perfect. But they still have that chemical imbalance in the brain where they don't feel true happiness on the core of the inside.
Mm.
So I just want to acknowledge that sometimes there's not a rhyme or reason. And I think that that is another reason why a lot of people are less tolerant with the idea of depression, because they say, well, what do you have to be depressed about? I've actually worked with children who I've diagnosed with depression. And the parents say things like, well, what do you have to be depressed about? You're only 10 years old and you have all the latest PlayStations and all the latest Jordans. And, you know, they go down the list of the material things that the child has. But that is a perfect example of how it's not always situational or material based when you have symptoms of depression and anxiety. You know,
the chemical imbalance, though, I mean, is that something as you go through your sessions that you start to get an idea is the case?
Yes and no. Okay. We do an assessment. As a licensed therapist, we're licensed to treat and diagnose, right? And so we have certain tools that we use to diagnose a patient. So usually before I start to really get into the treatment with you, I've done the different assessments that we have to use to help us to give the specific diagnosis.
Okay.
And then once we get into the sessions, other things are uncovered for sure. And then I'll be able to say, okay, well, this situation is really not helping the depression that's pre-existing, or this situation definitely doesn't help.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering about the sessions. And again, I'm going to let you walk the line of you want to do in terms of privacy. But
sure.
There must be lots and lots of surprises in these sessions, right?
Absolutely.
Where you're both, not just you, but the person that you're talking with, come to something that's just, I never thought of it like that before.
Mm-hmm.
Can you take us through understanding how that might come about and what you might experience?
Yeah. So avoidance is one of the most common defense mechanisms when it comes to trauma.
Mm.
And or different lived experiences. And so when a person has experienced something that they don't enjoy, something that can be traumatic, it is easier to just never think about it again than to feel the feels that comes with remembering that this situation happened.
Right.
And so because avoidance is a common defense mechanism, as a person starts to get comfortable in therapy and really start to talk about these things, they have different memories that come back to surface. And sometimes right on the spot, a person can become very tearful or very just like taken back, like, oh my gosh, this happened and this happened. And then they're really digging back into that memory of what happened once they break down that wall of avoidance. But it's helpful because sometimes, like, I have a client who deals with a lot of anger, and the client couldn't understand where the anger had come from. I have a family and I have children and I'm doing very well in my career, but I have a lot of built up anger. So I'm easily agitated sometimes, not sure why. I'm struggling with depression, not sure why. And what we figured out in session is that there was a lot of trauma in the past and a lot of built up feelings, of built up resentments that this client had carried for so many years, never dealt with, never found forgiveness for a person that may have wronged them, never forgiven themselves for decisions that they've made. And so because that's still on the inside, it manifests itself today, if that makes sense. So it's things like that that kind of come up in in conversation in therapy.
Forgiveness, can that be a big part of therapy?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I do a big series on forgiveness with a lot of people, because forgiveness is huge in trying to disconnect yourself from something that has happened to you. And it's a big part of just the mental wellness journey of finding forgiveness. And that could be finding forgiveness for yourself, finding forgiveness for a situation, finding forgiveness for a person that has wronged you. And one of the things that I always try to drill home to people is that forgiveness is for you, not for the other person.
Mm.
So a person that has wronged you, you are dealing every day with the feelings that comes with that, the embarrassment, the hurt, the guilt, the shame that comes with that. So every day you wake up with these feelings. But the person that has wronged you has already passed away 10 years ago, or the person that has already has wronged you is living their best life. You're the one who don't deserve it to still dealing with these feelings. So you're finding forgiveness so that you can let go of those feelings, not so that you can be best friends with the person that has wronged you. And so I always tell people that, like, when you're searching for forgiveness, forgiveness doesn't mean that we're friends again, or forgiveness doesn't mean that I condone what you did or what happened. Forgiveness just means that I am choosing to let go of the feelings that are associated with this thing, you know, my own mental.
Yeah. And you find then that breaks things down, that
absolutely
helps. Yeah,
absolutely. Now, me sitting here saying it verbally and explaining it makes it sound easy.
Right.
And it's very much not.
I wouldn't think so.
And it is a process, you know. And
do you really have to push people a little bit to try to get them?
Sure.
Yeah?
Sure. Because a lot of people are in that pre-contemplative stage of change where they're not even open to forgiveness. They don't even want to hear a thing I have to say when it comes to forgiveness. Mm. And so we have to start way up there as to, okay, what does forgiveness even mean? And, you know, things like that. Like, yeah, absolutely. It's a process. I've worked with a person and it took us about 6 months to really get there.
Wow.
Yeah, for sure.
And I'm curious about your technique here. I mean, again, that whole little line there, but how much do you say, okay, we're going to let that go for today or not? And how often do you say, no, we're not letting this go? I'm curious how you play that.
It's different strokes for different folks.
Sure.
Some people who are more mentally fragile, I am a lot more open to just letting it go. I'm coming back to it for sure.
Yeah.
But just letting it go. And some people will say to me, like, I need you to push me. I avoid things and I really need you to, you know, push. So I do my best to still be respectful and to go slow, but help you meet your goals.
Okay.
And so if you're asking me to help, to really help you and to be a little bit pushy to help you help yourself, you know, because sometimes I'm my own barrier in my success here because I just don't want to. So I won't. So I need somebody to give me that little nudge. And a lot of people will specifically ask for that. And then there's other people who I can tell that are, you know, a bit more mentally fragile. So they need just a much gentler touch. So it really, I kind of tailor my approach based on the person that's in front of me.
I'm wondering about fronts that people put up.
Mm-hmm.
And again, how...
I'm one of them.
There we go. There we go. I don't know how that kind of... That's Charles Gilbert joining us here. But maybe Charles and Carolyn can have this conversation then, Charles. You brought it up. You put up fronts. So you put up a front sometimes when you're talking to your therapist?
When I first started, yes, okay. I did. That's because my first therapy experience was not the best.
Okay.
It was very much, and I spoke about it on the last episode that I did. The therapist talked down on me.
Mm.
You know, like I just became a father and I'm going down this path of taking care of this responsibility that is on me and I don't know how to navigate and go through all of this. And the way he just talked to me, I walked out of there and said, I'll never do it again.
Mm.
But it was the strength of watching my daughter go through therapy. So as y'all were talking and you were talking about, you know, the children that have to go through trauma, that made me think about my daughter and what she has gone through and seeing her being able to sit there and have that conversation with a therapist, never seen them a day in her life, but she's able to let her guard down and just bear all. I'm like, why can't I do it? So when I first got to my therapy session, it was very much like I was guarded. I was like, I'm got to get a feel for this person. But the one thing that my therapist told me, and I tell this to people when I speak about therapy, is my therapist told me she's just a wall. And whatever you're saying eventually is going to bounce off and hit you. And everything's going to kind of, as like Carolyn was saying, come back. Like all those things that you thought you got rid of will start to resurface. And then you'll start to remember those things. And, it really made me, like, this whole conversation has had me sitting back, taking notes, trying to figure out, like, how can I interject? But one of the questions that I have, and this kind of goes back to the foster portion of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you were saying how, like, the kids have to deal with these things. How do you navigate or how do you, like, go through that process when the kid doesn't feel like they're good enough? So, like... when they are, because I know different circumstances happen, that's why kids are in foster care. But what happens when, like, you have that one that's just so adamant that, like, they don't understand why they were put here? Mm-hmm. Like, why is it that my parents don't want me?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you have to, I think that you have to constantly affirm a child. And I'm not even just talking about a child that's dealing with their own mental health and self-esteem issues. You have to constantly affirm any child so that, because children are sponges, right? And in order for them to develop confidence and self-esteem, you always have to pour that into a child.
Right.
And so constantly reminding a child that, oh my gosh, you've done a good job. And then you have to just every little thing that they do, thank them and praise them for it so that they know they are doing a good job, that you are doing well. And then when it comes to the parent, I always try to find a way with kid gloves on to talk to a child. And so mommy has to go to the doctor because mommy's trying to get better. She's trying to work on herself. So she asked me to watch you. Mom is my friend and we're going to hang out for a little bit. Mom trusts me to hang out with you while she goes to see the doctor so that she can get well. And you just give them just enough that makes it make sense,
mm-hmm.
but without like overdoing it for a child, things that they don't need to know. They don't need to know that mom's actually in rehab or mom's actually in jail or, you know what I mean? You don't have to give that level of a detail. But mom's doing so good. She's trying to work on herself because she's having a hard time. She's not really feeling well right now. So mom is asking me to hang out with you. And then I say things like, oh my gosh, I can't wait to tell your mom you did that. Your mom is going to be so proud. Oh my gosh, let's make this for mommy. And you're always going to include their parent in what they're doing so that they feel validated, not just by you, but by their parent as well. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It does.
And I'm wondering, Carolyn Kirkwood, as you heard Charles talk about his initial experience, wasn't a positive one, but that front.
Mm-hmm.
How quick as a therapist do you pick up on that?
Well, every day, literally okay. every day. But I am a therapist, so I do this every day. So I'm very good about connecting with people on a personal level and making people feel comfortable. And one of my opening lines every time I meet a new patient, I say, this is your safe space and you're allowed to talk about absolutely anything you want here. No topic is off limits. So that includes children and finances, mental health, sex, just literally anything that you want to talk about here. This is your safe space to say without judgment. And I tell them, I said, you'll get out of therapy what you put in. So I encourage you every time you come here to be your best normal self. You don't have to use perfect language here. You don't have to use your work voice like you are at work. You don't even have to bring that person that goes to work every day because that person is already perfect. That person puts on their shirt and their tie and they go to work and they're perfect, right? Leave that person at work. I want you to be the person that you are late at night when you're in your feelings, the person that you are on an everyday basis when you wake up in the morning and, you know, when the cameras are off. That is the person that needs the work because that's the person that's not perfect. So if you need to drop an F-bomb to express yourself, you're allowed to do that here and that's okay. And I actually say that to people every single time I meet a new person. And just being able to say that really helps a person to truly like, okay, I can let my shoulders down a little bit, you know, because it's hard to use your perfect work voice to code switch while you're also talking about your innermost feelings. And so having a person that you can just be normal with just truly helps break down that barrier.
And Charles, I'm curious then about your experience. I guess, you know, you're continuing to seek therapy or you've been in therapy continuing. Do you find that experience that you and those moments can be your true self?
Now I can.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Took some time.
Yeah, it did. With my therapist, it didn't take as long as I thought it would. But I bear all to my therapist. I have cried to my therapist. I have expressed anger. There's times where I just will say, I really don't know what I'm feeling at this moment, just because it's so much that's going on. That is like, I don't know why I'm feeling the way I'm feeling. Like there's days where I will be perfectly fine. But then a split second, something happens. And then it's just like, I don't know why I feel like this now.
Right.
You know, and it's still like a lot of stuff that I have to overcome. Y'all were speaking about forgiveness. And that's something that I had to endure within the past few years with my father.
Hmm.
And I had to come to peace with that. I had to come to peace with knowing that, hey, this is kind of what it is.
Mm-hmm.
I have to be able, like she said, be able to forgive for myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have to be able to be like, okay, I know this is not going to change. The relationship is never going to be better. So I have to be okay and accept the fact that we have gone our separate ways. So it's very challenging, even with me being in therapy for the amount of years that I've been in, just because there's still like a small part of me that still has that mindset. And it's very small that I have that mindset where it's like, I shouldn't be showing this much vulnerability,
mm-hmm.
you know, especially for like a man, especially for a black man, because we were always taught not to show it. I said it last time. I hate the terminology of show no love, love will get you killed. I despise that term because that's not how life should be. So that's kind of how I've taken all this.
So I heard you, Carolyn, a few times throughout Charles's conversation here that, you know, with some affirmation of your own that, yes, that sounded very familiar. What about what he just said right there about showing no love? I mean, that's heartfelt and a very strong statement.
Yeah, that is a strong statement. And it's statements like that has shaped the community into a space to where there's this big stigma around mental health. Another one that I've heard for a while is sticks and stones may break your bones, but words would never hurt. And that couldn't be further away from
right,
true.
Right.
Like, I don't know about anybody else, but I have been hurt by words many times in my life.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I broke my wrist when I was 12. I don't think about that as much as something disrespect that was came my way recently.
Exactly. You know? And so it's just working together to really break those, you know, those random quotes down, and just because they're not true, they're not real. That's not how life works. And it is okay to have feelings and emotions. Only the Tin Man doesn't have feelings, but any human being has feelings and has emotions. And it's very normal and okay to express those.
And Tin Man wanted a heart.
he may have gotten more than he bargained for. With us, it's Charles Gilbert, our producer, who's kind of stepping from behind the wall here and entering our conversation about mental health. And obviously, of course, most certainly appreciate the first person assistance on this as well. Carolyn Kirkwood from Kirkwood Therapy, licensed clinical social worker, our guest here on What's Next. You talked about the community, and we did get about this a little bit before we went on the air. Just, you know, this program aired not long after 5/14/22. And one of the really moving stories I heard about the, you know, setting up, you know, makeshift therapy sessions at Johnny B. Wiley and other places around the Jefferson Avenue neighborhood. But at the same time, that wall, there was a bit of a wall for people who didn't necessarily feel a sense of trust when they walked into a therapy session and found perhaps, you know, again, I'll use, you did a great job of correcting me, so I'll just use the same terminology. I saw, they walked in, they saw a white clinician, and they didn't feel a connection. They didn't feel that, that it was there for them. The importance that I brought up is the importance of having somebody who maybe looks like you when you go into your session. But why don't you give your own clarification to my assertions there?
So I think that sometimes it's not so much about the white clinician or, you know, the color of the clinician. I think it's more about the cultural connection to the person that you're speaking to. And if you don't feel that the person that you're talking to has the baseline understanding of who you are and your experiences, then it's very difficult to connect with them and to talk about the things that you're going through. And one example that always comes to mind when this comes up is I had a client who was expressing gratitude for working together in a therapeutic setting. And he was explaining that he had a therapist before, but he felt like he couldn't get to where he really needed to in therapy because she couldn't understand his cultural background. And he felt like he spent a lot of time in therapy explaining to her the background before he could talk about the situation at hand because she didn't understand the baseline. And so one of the examples he gave was, he was having trouble with a newborn baby and trying to buy food and buy diapers. And he was telling his therapist that he had his food stamps and he goes to the grocery store, but he's really trying to piece together money to try to make it all happen to provide for the baby. And then the therapist said to him, well, why don't you go to Tops and use your food stamps to buy the diapers because they sell diapers at Tops. And so if you can go to Tops to get the food, go to Tops and just get the diapers. And the client was very frustrated by that because she didn't understand what he was saying. And then he said that he had to explain to her that you can only use food stamps for food items. And that at the register won't scan back a non-food item when you're trying to use food stamps. And so, but because she has never used food stamps before, don't know anything about it, he had to spend 30 minutes explaining that to her before he could really talk about the hardship that he really experienced this week. So he left the session feeling the exact same way that he did when he walked in, maybe even a little bit more frustrated because he spent all the time explaining that background story versus being able to talk about, this is the hardship that I'm experiencing this week and I'm trying to get this off my chest. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And so it was that moment where he felt like, I can't talk to somebody that don't get it because she doesn't understand what poverty really looks like. She doesn't understand what public assistance and food stamps, that entire system, really looks like. And so because that is my world and that is my life, I can't talk to somebody who don't have that foundational understanding. So,
and Charles, if you don't mind us coming back to you here for just one, because you did mention your first encounter with a therapist that you felt, I think I used the term, kind of talked down to you or looked down upon you to a certain extent. What can you share, if you don't mind, your experience about that? That, because we just heard here from Carolyn about a client that she worked with who had kind of a little more specific, I suppose, but at the same time, obviously felt a million miles away from their therapist at that time. How about for you? What can you share?
Yeah, he talked down, like I said, talked down on me. He talked to me as if I was a kid. Mm. You know, he was like really like coddling me, like being like, oh, well, talked like kind of just the way like you would talk to your child.
Right.
You know, and it's like, I'm 19. You can talk to me like I'm an adult, like talk to me, like don't look at me as this. And, you know, when I'm trying to tell them, like, I'm trying to put my words together, like, this is what I don't really know, even know how I'm feeling. And he was just like, well, I don't really think that, you know, you like. And it was like an older white man, too. Mm-hmm. So it was very much like.
So just added to the experience
yes,
in that regard.
Mm-hmm. It was very much where he wasn't understanding. Okay, I am a young black father who just had a kid not even 2 months ago. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to navigate this, trying to deal with my emotions, my feelings, along with the relationship that I'm in. I need help trying to figure out all this stuff. I don't want to end up being like how my father was. So I'm holding that weight on me as well. And you're not even looking at me as a man. You're looking at me as a kid. Mm-hmm. And it really caused that, you know, I was frustrated, you know, like she was saying, to the point where like I left. And that's when I said never again, because I was ready to cuss him out, yes. Mm-hmm. Probably do more, yes, because I was that angry. Mm-hmm. And I was that frustrated because it's mm-hmm. like, you're not hearing me. So.
And that's well stated there for sure. And I'm going to turn this now to you, Carolyn, as a mm-hmm. professional. You most certainly can understand how Charles felt at that time for sure. But as a professional for you, how do you keep yourself in check? How do you review yourself to make mm-hmm. sure that you don't fall into pitfalls? I'm sure there you might even find yourself occasionally slipping into something.
So cultural competence is very important to me. And I don't know everything and I don't have all the experiences. And so when I meet a client who I have no familiarity with their background, I will ask. And so I spent the first session with this one particular client who was from like Pakistan, I believe. So like I got nothing,
right.
You know? And so I have a series of questions that I do with any client, and I did that. And then we spent the last part of the session. I said, okay, can you help me understand, what do I need to know about your culture? Help me to understand who you are, the things that are important to you, so that I know how to treat you. And she did that. And one of the things that she was very tearful towards the end of the session, and she was saying how grateful she was for that. And she thanked me a lot for that. And she was kind of really looking forward to going forward with me as a therapist, because she said that the reason why she had stopped with her last therapist was because she didn't feel that the therapist understood her culturally and she didn't feel safe there. And the example that she gave was that in her culture, it is very common for all their family to live together. Okay. So this client and their spouse, the client's sibling and the sibling spouse, and their parents and grandparents all lived in the same house.
Okay.
And so it was several generations of the family with their spouses and their children. They all lived in one house. And that is how the culture is designed, right? They have like arranged marriages and things like that. And that's how it is. And so she was talking about some of the challenges in her home and how the family was getting on her nerves or whatever. And the therapist said to her, why don't you just move out? And she felt very disrespected by that, because that is not a thing in her culture at all whatsoever. And she never went back to the therapist and never felt connected or truly understood by that therapist because of that. And so cultural competence had always been important to me, which is why I led the session like that. But it just gave me a little bit more push to make sure that I am always growing, always learning with different cultures. And if I don't know, I just ask. So that now I would never say anything like that anyways.
Right.
But because she explained to me in the first session that that is important in her culture, I knew that I had to design my treatment around that being the situation, and that we're just working through that as it is.
We're coming down to our final few minutes here with Carolyn Kirkwood, and also Charles Gilbert, our producer, helping out as well on this program. It's about mental health, a more general topic, but Carolyn specifically is a licensed clinical social worker and has her own therapy, or her own practice called Kirkwood Therapy. Boy, you know, you've really done a great job here of bringing us to a lot of different subjects that could most certainly be explored here. But I'm interested in that cultural competency.
Mm-hmm.
When did you realize how important that was for what you do?
It was a big thing in social work school when I got my graduate degree. We had to take several courses on cultural competence. So it was something that I had learned. And then in my internships, there was different trainings that we had to take on cultural competence. And then I learned it just from working with people. Like, you have to understand their culture and their background in order to ever get anywhere with them in a therapeutic session. In order for them to feel comfortable opening up and being their most vulnerable self, you have to understand their culture. So it's something that I've just really taken serious and just really, really connect to in my work that I do every day.
I'm going to ask you to maybe just step a little beyond the profession here. And if it gets into an area of too much opinion,
sure,
you're welcome to obviously step aside from this. But as you're talking about, you know, so cultural competence is important to be a good therapist. And I think you've laid it out very well there. At the same time, I'm looking at a culture.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'll use our country as our culture.
Mm-hmm.
It seems in some regards, and I don't want to say overwhelming majority, but most certainly there is a portion of the populace that doesn't seem to have any interest in cultural competency or mm-hmm. cultural competence.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering about that.
Mm-hmm.
Could this world benefit from more cultural competence?
I think so. Sure. I think so. Yeah, I think that it could definitely benefit from more cultural competence. But people have to be like open to it. And
right.
If you're not open to it, it's hard.
What are they missing?
Maybe cultural competency trainings. The willingness and openness to be more culturally competent, because you can't really fix something that's not broken. So if you don't see an issue with it, then you can't fix it. So we have to have more people that are open-minded to seeing that there is an issue there and being open and willing to fix it.
What about moving forward for you? Are you taking, is there like professional development, things along those lines? Yeah.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I try to do professional development monthly. And in order to stay licensed, you have to do certain number of continuing education credits to renew your license every 3 years. So it's also a part of the state requirement. But a lot of it I do, I because it's a state requirement, I do it, but I specifically pick the trainings that I do that can help me to continue and to develop as a clinician.
Okay.
And anything that directly impacts my work day to day. So for example, I'm seeing an increase in eating disorders. And so I am looking for more and more trainings on eating disorders, just so that I can be the best clinician that I can when I'm offering services to people and have as much knowledge as I can to be able to help people.
Carolyn, I think with every question, you give me like three or four more questions. I'm curious about, I don't want to diminish it in any way, but to hear that eating disorders are something that you're seeing more of, I mean, can you put any kind of larger understanding to why that's the case?
I believe that eating disorders have always been a thing. And I think now people are being more honest about it. And eating disorders, a lot of times people only talk about the deficits where people limit the eating and they maybe purge.
Right.
But people don't, more common than that is binge eating disorders, where people overeat and overconsume food. And it's very common for people to overconsume to deal with feelings. How often do you hear people say, I'm in my feelings, I'm just going to have a bowl of ice cream, or I'm going to, you know.
Right.
Now, having a bowl of ice cream when you're in your feelings, I'm not going to diagnose that as an issue.
Right.
But I'm saying people do take it, you know, seven steps further.
Sure.
And, you know, consume an entire buffet just to kind of mask the feelings that they're feeling and just kind of, you know, disconnect from reality.
Right. Right. Yeah. That's an interesting element. So, but yet you have to, you know, you're pushing yourself though to kind of always make sure that you're staying with the changes of things.
Yeah. I love educating myself. I love learning new things. It also helps me stay connected to the client. So when I have young clients and they speak their lingo, I always say, what does that mean? Because I need to know. So now when I work with teenagers, I kind of know the lingo. I have three teenagers myself, so that helps too. And then I learn different things working with the clients too, so that now I am connected to the culture, to the generation, you know. So I don't just educate myself with the textbook stuff, but just like culturally too.
And Charles, if you don't mind chiming in here the last couple of minutes, it's going to be the same question for you and for Carolyn, but coming at it from a different perspective. Carolyn, I'm going to ask you to tell us why people should come to see her, but I'm going to ask you, why do you believe somebody should seek, or who should seek therapy, mental health, and take a proactive approach to their mental health?
I think everybody at some point needs to seek therapy. I feel like that because I feel like everybody has experienced some form of trauma. And it helps you understand more of like why you react to certain things, and it helps you manage how you react to it. Like now I'm less prone to be angry. Like Jay, I've been here for about almost 3 years now. I don't think you've ever really seen me angry.
No. And unfortunately you can't say that about me.
But it's also because like even when I'm here, like everybody that's the timer. Everybody here kind of says that I have this calming presence. And I credit a lot of that to therapy, because it taught me how to just really not get angry about everything, kind of see things from a different lens and learn how to control what only I have control of.
And Carolyn, to you, why should somebody come to therapy, whether it's with you or anybody else?
I think that therapy can just help you to be your best self, really. It can help you learn how to communicate your feelings, to connect with your feelings yourself. And I think specifically at Kirkwood Therapy, I think that people should give it a try, because we are a unique practice. We accept insurance companies, including Medicaid. We also take cash payments. We are a telehealth platform, so you can access it from anywhere as long as you have internet and a device with camera. We're also starting to offer bilingual services. So we are really working towards just expanding our reach to be able to help all types of different families. We offer evening and weekend hours so that people, the average person works, you know,
right.
And so they can't come to therapy until 5 or 6 o'clock or maybe a Saturday morning. So we on purpose offer evening and weekend hours as well. And I really think that, you know, everybody can really benefit from just connecting with their innermost feelings.
Charles Gilbert, you're always there behind the board. So I'll thank you for being with us today and every day on What's Next. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Carolyn Kirkwood, thank you so much for coming and talking to us today. It's been great. This has been What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.